From the Sky News Centre at 5, thousands of England and Algeria fans are creating a carnival atmosphere in Cape Town ahead of tonight's World Cup match. Supporters of both teams have been mixing at the city's waterfront close to the stadium. Many England fans are in fancy dress, ranging from Mr Bean to St George, and think Algeria will be disappointed.
It's just not going to happen, is it? They're nowhere near as good a team as England are.
We have the quality. We got the quality. We didn't produce in the USA game, but when it matters, that's when England produce.
The USA have come from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with Slovenia in their World Cup match. Earlier, Germany suffered a shock 1-0 defeat to Serbia in Group D. In other news, schools could soon be set up by parents and teachers as part of a government plan to improve classroom standards. Applications can be put in for state funding from today to help create so-called free schools. Education Secretary Michael Gove says it's an idea that's worked in the US.
Some of the most impressive schools, the so-called charter schools, have been set up outside local government control by teachers. And these schools have done an amazing job in transforming the opportunities for young children, particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds.
A British soldier from the Royal Dragoon Guards has been killed in an explosion in Afghanistan today. The Ministry of Defence says his family have been told. The funeral's taking place of a man who killed 12 people in a shooting spree in Cumbria. Derek Bird turned the gun on himself after going on the rampage just over 2 weeks ago. Earlier today, a funeral took place for the taxi driver's youngest victim, Jamie Clark. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been visiting Britain today to mark the 70th anniversary of a historic radio broadcast by one of his predecessors. Charles de Gaulle flew to London in 1940 after the Nazis invaded his country. His broadcast inspired the French resistance movement. Severe weather warnings have been issued for this evening for parts of Wales and the West Country. The Met Office says to expect heavy rain, advising extra care on the roads and motorways. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Seventh-day Adventist Church presents Impact Bristol, the March Against Crime, kicking off at 2:30 sharp at Eastville Park, marching to Castle Park. There you will find stalls and information. Leads on to a concert at the waterfront from 4:30 to 6:30. Then the gospel concert at the Baptist Church, City Road, St. Paul's, Bristol, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m.
For more information, contact Colin on 07 9844 33075, or check out the website www.bristolcentral.adventistchurch.org. Remember, this is all free. Impact Bristol, Saturday the 19th of June.
Are you discouraged or disheartened? Are you in distress or in debt? Do you feel that you are unlucky? Does your child need help with schoolwork? If you have answered yes to any one of the questions, come and learn how to become a champion and be victorious over these challenges using dynamic biblical principles at Champions House. Every Sunday, 12 to 2, City Academy, Bristol, Carlton House, Redfield. www.championshouse.com.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Liberal Democrat Councillor for Clifton East and Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council, Simon Cook. After the 6 o'clock news, a detailed look at Chancellor George Osborne's Mansion House speech. And our former Parachute Regiment reporter, Bryn Richard Cowley, looks at the big news of the week. That is the Savile report, which came out into the Bloody Sunday killings this week. Has the £191 million reports thrown any light on whether soldiers, senior officers or politicians of the day were responsible? And Mike Birkin is here from Bristol Friends of the Earth to look at the announcement this week that brings two new nuclear power stations on our doorstep a little bit closer. And he'll be also explaining the coming public inquiry into the proposed Avonmouth biofuel power station. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-week weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, averaging 16 degrees Celsius and dry with plenty of sun. Next week, averaging 20, that's even warmer, sunnier at the beginning of the week, but getting cloudier with some rain on Thursday. Next weekend, 26th and 27th of June, also averaging 16 degrees Celsius. That's the same temperature pretty much as this weekend, but showery with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. So with me is Liberal Democrat councillor for Clifton East and deputy leader of Bristol City Council, Simon Cook. Hello, Simon, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, good to be here.
Now, are you from Bristol yourself?
Well, not originally. I was born in Norwich and educated there and went to the University of Sussex. Went back to Norwich for a bit to work in business, and then I came to Bristol to train at Bristol Ovic Theatre School.
And how long have you actually been a councillor?
11 years.
And what about your professional background? You mentioned something about the Old Vic Theatre School there.
Yeah, I'm a professional actor. I worked in the theatre and television for 20 years, and then in 1999, some idiot persuaded me to stand for the council, and so I've sort of blended the two ever since.
Now, some people think this is a bit controversial. I mean, the worst example possibly was Ronald Reagan as an actor turning politician. Do you ever get ribbed about that?
No, I don't. No, probably because I've never achieved the heights of being President of the United States or being elected to the British Parliament or anything. No, I think actually being a local councillor and combining a job as well works quite well.
Okay, so what does the deputy leader do?
The deputy leader deputises for the leader. I step in for the leader for things she can't make and some meetings where she has diary clashes and generally act as her number two, mentor, advisor.
Now, as someone who's sort of close to the apex here politically in Bristol, how does it all work between the senior politicians and people like the chief executive, the people who are actually making and delivering services day to day?
We have regular conversations, we have regular briefings from the senior leadership team, and generally keep in close contact. And they know that for a set period of time, and in Bristol, the administration's reappointed every year, so they know for that year, for the ruling party, which we are at the moment, majority party, they are there to implement our policies as well as run the everyday services of the council.
Now, you've been doing this for a little while now. What is your vision for the city?
Oh, Andy, well, how long have you got? Well, look, speaking for my own portfolio, I'm a portfolio holder for culture, sport and capital projects. I want to see Bristol become a leading European city. I think we have a stunning offer in so many ways. Culturally, you know, we have wonderful cultural activity, and not just the kind of the high-profile stuff like the Colson Hall and the Bristol Old Vic and Watershed. But, I mean, the amount of community activity, if you like. I mean, the music scene in Bristol just on its own is absolutely amazing. So this is an incredible place. And also, if you, it is a very, very beautiful city. It's one of the greenest cities. And I mean green in terms of green, you know, just open space and parks. And then you've got the docks and the harbour and lots of wonderful buildings. It really is a stunning place to live. There's a really good quality of life here. And so I just want to tell that to the rest of the world, you know, so that we go on getting the inward investment, attracting the skilled people we need to work in our businesses and our hospitals and our universities, and get the business relocation, people who want to relocate their businesses here, so that we maintain the job levels, the employment levels, because we've got so much to offer.
The trouble is, though, of course, politicians are always having to prioritise. There's never quite enough money to go round. How do you make those sort of decisions about what's going to go ahead and what isn't?
Well, there's no money at the moment. We get less money as every day goes by, I think. Every time the government makes an announcement, something's been pulled back. So it's very difficult at the moment. But we have to make those decisions day to day, and they're very hard because the government are setting us targets. For instance, they've just told us we've got to pull 3.1 million out of this year's budget. We'd been planning on reductions in our government support grant from April next year onwards, but they've told we actually got to prune this year's budget. So we have to look at every service area, we have to look how we deliver services, we think how we can deliver those better, more efficiently, and make changes in each case. But, you know, that's, you have to get into heavy detail to do that.
Do you find it sometimes difficult to be proactive, you know, sort of creative politically, when you're hit with things like these cuts? It's, I mean, that's kind of forcing you to be reacting all the time, isn't it?
It's a sort of,
you know, so how do you manage to square that circle?
Well, it's very much about trying to protect the essential services we deliver at the coalface, so that you don't want those to draw back. So then all the different services we offer, and there's lots and lots, from education to highways to social care to culture, but you don't want to affect the amount of money that's spent out in the city. So what we're trying to do is look at ways of economising in the way we deliver those services. But you obviously want to try and protect what we offer to other people.
Now, with the general election, there were some big changes, with the Liberal Democrat Party getting into bed with the Conservatives and the Cameron and Clegg marriage. Can it last?
Yeah, I think it can. I think it's a five-year agreement, and I think there is a lot of agreement about the really important things we need to do. And crudely, you could say that's cuts. It's not cuts. It's just looking at ways of changing the focus of spending. And I think what they'll be doing is postponing a lot of projects, but not necessarily cancelling them, but just spreading them over a longer time period. And I think there's lots of other things which we agree upon. And the green agenda, for instance, I think, with the exception of nuclear, I think, you know, there's a lot of agreements, and on constitutional change, in some ways, I think we will probably get more of what we're looking for from the Tories than we would from Labour. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of agreement, and I think it's a very good document that's been produced, and both parties have thought very hard about it, and I see no reason at all why it shouldn't last. And I think actually there'll be a lack of credibility for both parties if it doesn't.
But aren't you going to suffer at the polls? We'll see next year, I suppose, because people voted for the Liberal Democrats, and for at least a while a delay in the cuts, so the economy's got a chance to pick up. I mean, this is what Vince Cable was saying before the general election, and now we're being told all that's out the window. We've got to get cutting now. In fact, we've got to cut, as you just said, present budgets, not just next year's, this year's budget is being cut.
I think most people realise the dreadful reality of this country's situation, which is, you know, we owe huge amounts of money. Unless we find ways of creatively paying that back, getting our economy back on track, we will lose our credit rating. That would be disastrous for the country, and it could lead to a run on the pound, collapse in shares, and the economy of the country really suffering. So I think people realise it's a very, very difficult job to do. I hope they think that both parties have acted very maturely, getting together, setting aside some of the things they wanted to do, but assembling a core set of values, a core set of policies which they can both agree upon, and acting very, very quickly to solve the basic problems that are facing the country. I would hope that people think we've been good about that, mature, responsible, and they will judge us in the ballot box accordingly.
Now, Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist, is here too. Martin, I want to ask you about these ratings agencies Simon's just mentioned. Can you explain who they are and how come they seem to have so much power over the financial markets?
Well, I mean, these are the same rating agencies which might downgrade Britain's national debt, who rated all of this junk that was swallowing around in the private markets as AAA some years ago. They're effectively an oligopoly of three ratings agencies, and a lot of what's going on, to my mind, is essentially a confidence trick.
But why do you call them an oligopoly? I mean, they're just three companies.
No, an oligopoly is where you have, if you've got a market with three main players in it, which is what you've got with the ratings agencies, they tend to collude in what they say, because there's not sufficient competition. And of course, there's a real question about what kind of power actually resides within these rating agencies, and what how they decide what they what they call a good bet and a bad bet. And all of this stuff ought to have been looked at more seriously than it has been. We're now saying, oh, the markets are saying this, the markets are saying that. These are the same markets that we rescued 2 years ago with taxpayers' money. Now, in actual fact, we're now taking orders from these markets that we've just rescued. We need a sea change in people's perception of how the financial system works. All of this so-called common sense about cuts isn't really common sense, and I think that people will... Danny Banchfar, for example, used to sit on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, said last week that he's certain now, 100% certain, there will be a double-dip recession. He called everything right up to now. I think he's right about this as well. Cuts is actually wrong, not just now, but in the future.
Okay, well, let's get straight into this topic of cuts as we have a look at this week's news. And our first audio clip is from George Osborne, who gave his speech a couple of days ago, is the annual speech at the City of London's Mansion House.
No one was controlling levels of debt, and when the crunch came, no one knew who was in charge. Now, some lessons have been learnt and some changes made, and I commend those who have led this process. But despite those changes, the government is still not confident that the fundamental problems of culture and regulatory structure have been confronted. How do we ensure, as you asked, Lord Mayor, less box-ticking and more exercise of judgment? What are the tools of macroprudential regulation, and who should exercise them? Can the macroprudential regulator do their job if they don't have an intimate knowledge of what is happening in individual firms?
Now, that was the Chancellor George Osborne speaking earlier this week. The macroprudential regulator, Martin, what exactly does he mean by that?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I think he's just made that phrase up.
It's an offshoot of the Bank of England, apparently, which is going to be doing the job that the old Financial Services Authority used to do, regulating the city.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, that's what it will do. I mean, the Financial Services Authority, I think, wasn't fit for purpose, so there is room for change there. In fact, there's room for a lot more change than's being suggested. What's shocked me about the FSA, which I didn't realise until a few years ago when I actually met somebody who worked for it, is that in actual fact it's an industry body. It's not actually a national body at all. It was actually controlled by the City of London, much like the Federal Reserve in the United States of America, which is actually privately owned. At least the Bank of England is ostensibly owned by the public, although, of course, we have the problem of regulatory capture. They tend to say what the city wants to hear.
Now, Simon, I'm a bit concerned about George Osborne, this speech he made at the Mansion House, because there he is telling the very people who it seems are responsible to a large part for the recession exactly what they wanted to hear. That is, that the government are going to do just what the city wants.
Well, hopefully what's going on back at the Treasury is a real hard look at the banks. And I know Vince Cable had as part of our manifesto that we should break up the banks. That is being seriously looked at, so that you separate the ordinary everyday banking that looks after the money of the ME from the kind of speculative, what he calls casino banking, they indulged in to such a disastrous effect. So hopefully what will come out of the Treasury over the next few months is some more decisive action on controlling that kind of activity.
Are you happy with that, Martin?
Yeah, I am. I mean, insofar as the Coalition does things which are sensible, then I think that, you know, the opposition should support them. I think we should break up the banks, but of course there's a problem here, because we've actually been aggregating banks together in order to protect them from collapse, and then at the same time we're trying to break them up. So Northern Rock are now being RBS are now being told they've got to sell off a large chunk of their business to Santander, or offering to buy it. So we've got a bit of confusion in policy here. We're either aggregating banks together to stop them collapsing, and then we're going to break them up. Now, I think this whole idea of breaking up banks is based on the idea that competition is good, and we're still in this ideological mentality that competition will solve all problems. I don't think it will. It might be better to aggregate banks together and not even regulate them properly, perhaps run them as a public service, or at the very least have a core banking system which is publicly run, like the Bank of North Dakota, which is owned by the state of North Dakota, and they don't ban private banks, but essentially a large chunk of the banking system in North Dakota is run by the local government. Now, these kind of radical measures are not being talked about by anybody, and I include the Labour front bench in this. They've all missed the trick in my view. We will only get real radical change when people realise that this business as usual approach isn't working, and that will become quite clear long before 5 years is
up. But Martin, what you're talking about there really is nationalisation of the banks. That is absolutely the last thing, surely, on this
we've
government
done it.
Or anyone else.
What we've done it. We have
not the money for it.
We have nationalised the banks, and there isn't the money for it, and that's why we've got to have all these cuts supposedly. Now the problem is that we've done this, but we haven't. We're trying to kid ourselves that we haven't done it. Effectively, the financial system has been backed up by the taxpayer. That's all there is to it. But the taxpayer has not, in fact, got the real power over the system that one might expect, having chucked all this money at it. So we paid for all of this, but we're still being told what to do by the privately run managers of these banks. And we've got to have a culture change at the top. And if the coalition is prepared to clean out the dead wood and have a culture change, then I think we should cheer and clap. But I suspect that this is very, very half-hearted, and that there may be tensions within the coalition between people like Vince Cable, who in the past have talked quite sensibly about this, and people like George Osborne, who in my view have talked quite stupidly about it.
I'll give you the final word on this, Simon, because the danger is that the Lib Dems are now going to be seen as doing the bank's dirty work for them, aren't they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what surprised me actually during the Labour government was that we did, you're right, saying that we nationalised the banks, or some of them. Some like Barclays scuttled off and got loans from elsewhere, but some were nationalised. And we didn't seem to use the very powerful position we then had on the boards of those banks to make them lend and to make them invest properly. They just seemed to be allowed to go on behaving exactly as they wanted, including paying bonuses. So I hope that this government, you know, takes a far tougher line with them and actually brings them into line and introduces reform that's really going to make a difference.
I think what we're going to do is just rewind slightly back to the cuts and have a listen to Mike about his union's plans next week and over the next few weeks to resist some of the cutbacks.
My name's Mike Wheeler. I'm a branch assistant secretary with the Public and Commercial Services Union in Bristol. Well, we're already seeing at the moment fixed term contract staff likely to not be kept on. We have some offices that up to 80% of staff are on fixed term contracts and they're in limbo to know whether they're going to still be in work. We're seeing in the job centres the very schemes brought in to help people into work and that are working to help people into work being scrapped on a daily basis, which is actually, you know, stopping us being able to do our job. And that's before they actually bring in the actual job cuts on us and the attacks on our pensions and, you know, terms and conditions.
So is there anything that you can do as a union to resist this?
It's simple. There are no cuts. We don't need to cut. There's £130 billion a year uncollected in taxes. The first thing we need to do is not cut our tax collectors. We need to invest in them because it's shown that, you know, they collect up to nine times their own salary. So, you know, why should ordinary working people have to pay for the banks?
But at the end of the day, they are pulling the purse strings, aren't they? Is there anything you can really do to avoid redundancies?
There is. We can say it's not acceptable. We can say, why should I have to pay? The job needs to be done. We've been struggling as it is. We lose the staff. There's going to be more people signing on. We're already 3 million people unemployed. Do we really want to increase that figure? We're less staff to actually help them. And if we think there's issues with benefit delivery now, how bad is it going to be when there's less staff delivering it? I mean, we've got a cabinet with over 20 millionaires in, so when they talk about removing free school dinners, removing breakfast clubs from schools, are they really going to be the people that are going to feel the effect of this? It's us. It's the people that can't afford to lose these schemes. And the people that can afford to, the people that can afford to have all these cuts, are still going to be benefiting. 1,000 richest people in the United Kingdom, while we've been in recession, their income's gone up by 30%. How is that fair when most of us are struggling to pay the bills?
So that was Mike Wheeler from the local branch of the PCS Public Servants Union. And now we're going to hear from Dick North, who's from the National Union of Teachers here in Bristol.
My name's Dick North of National Union of the Teachers, and I'm the chair of the Joint Trade Unions Bristol City Council. Next week we're having a demonstration on Budget Day, the 22nd of June, to protest against what we know is going to be a major tranche of cuts imposed by the Tory Lib Dem alliance, and also the City Council senior officers meeting the same day to pass on the £3.1 million worth of cuts in Bristol that have been insisted on to be made before the end of this year. We think it's time for all the unions to get together and resist this.
The trouble is, though, that the government are just going to withdraw the amount of money from the City Council, and there simply are going to have to be redundancies. You don't have any choice.
Whether we have any choice or not depends on how vigorously we resist. I mean, people said that we didn't have any choice but to swallow the poll tax. It depends exactly how hard people fight. I know that even in our council there are some anxieties that that maybe, particularly as they're Liberals, they will find it very difficult to deliver the Lib Conservative cuts and still retain the support of their own people. So I think the more pressure we put on, the better.
Okay, and so where and when is it taking place?
It's taking place on College Green at 4:30. We've got most of the public sector unions are supporting it, unions in the private sector as well, because we don't want a division between them. But perhaps more significantly, we're planning for a meeting of all the unions on the 8th of July, again in the council chamber, and that will be working out the plan of action. So 22nd is the protest, 8th of July, planning for serious action. We're ready for it.
So that's 4:30 on next Tuesday. There's going to be a little rally on College Green, Simon. Is it true what Dick North from the National Union of Teachers said there, that it's going to be difficult for a Liberal Democrat administration here in Bristol to deliver these Conservative Liberal cuts from Westminster?
Well, we can't spend money that we haven't got. It's difficult for any administration to have to spend less money than you're spending at the moment. It doesn't matter where the diktat comes from, and it doesn't matter who's having to deliver it. If you haven't got the money, you can't spend it.
All right, for our next story, we're going back for a couple of weeks ago to the raid by the Israeli commandos on the flotilla heading for Gaza across the Mediterranean Sea. And we're going to hear from one lady who was on a neighbouring boat to the main one, which was attacked by the commandos, called Alex Harrison. The reason that I want to have a listen to this is that as the weeks go by, or a couple of weeks after the main event, all sorts of other information is coming out. Because as Alex alleges, that the Israelis were very, very clear they didn't want any information at the time to get out about what had happened there at all.
On the boat, after the rest of the journey, we were subject to abuse and humiliation. An 8-year-old passenger on our boat was, when he asked to go to the toilet, was told to do it on himself, and eventually he had to. Before we were boarded, we heard and saw the beginnings of the attack on the Marmara, and as we pulled around them, ourselves being pursued, we saw the helicopter coming down and we heard the sound of live gunfire. We radioed Captain Mehmet on the Marmara and asked him what we should do. Should we stick close together with him for solidarity? The brave captain just told us that he was under attack, but that we must go on, sail on, and try to get the footage out, try to outsail the communications blockout they had us under and get the footage out. 9 incredibly brave people on the Marmara, well, hundreds of incredibly brave people, but 9 incredibly brave people on the Marmara lost their lives, and I'm determined that that must not be in vain. When we were in prison, we were held incommunicado, and I had no idea of the response outside. I had no idea that we'd had so much support, and I'm thrilled that while we were in prison I had over 1,000 emails, and I had over 100 emails of people asking me how to join the organisation and how to support us.
That was Alex Harrison there, who was involved in the Gaza aid flotilla, which was raided a few weeks ago. Now, Alex was talking, Martin, there, about the Israeli attempt to sort of stop any footage or any film information coming out at the time. And, of course, most of what she's had to say really hasn't made the news, because by the 2 weeks afterwards, when she made that speech there, this isn't news anymore.
Yeah, well, the Israelis obviously have a very slick PR operation and news management operation, so they seized all of the footage they could, preventing people from getting independent pictures of anything that had happened, and they've not released any of that footage. Incidentally, there are 2 Bristol participants who are on the Marmara are going to be speaking at Eastern Community Centre next Wednesday at 7:30 on the 23rd. That's Cliff Hanley and Shakir Yildirim, I believe, are going to be talking, because they were both on the Marmara and saw people murdered in front of them, and they'll be giving their eyewitness account of what happened next Wednesday at Eastern Community Centre. And that, in a way, is all that we're left with, is to take all the people that were actually there and get their word out into the community, because the Israelis have actually managed the mainstream media pretty ruthlessly.
Now, Simon, I know that the ruling Lib Dem group has actually taken quite a robust position on this.
Yeah, we're bringing a motion to next council on the 29th of June condemning the attack on the flotilla, and really highlighting the plight of the people in Gaza, which is quite desperate. And, you know, the main aim of this flotilla was to try and bring aid to those people. And I think the attitude and the actions of the Israelis has been quite appalling.
But, I mean, what the Israeli and Netanyahu, the Prime Minister particularly, is what the Israelis are saying is that they're simply doing this to protect themselves. They see these people as terrorists.
I know, this is what's constantly said, but, you know, I fundamentally think you have to go back to several decades back to what happened after the Arab-Israeli wars, where the Israelis refused to go back to their original boundaries, and they refused to give up the other half of Jerusalem, and they basically make the possibility of the Palestinians having a state and living peacefully with Israel impossible. Until that position changes, the threat to Israel will not change, and there is this ongoing intransigence which is maintained by American support, because the American vote, the Jewish vote, is so strong in America. I think that Israel has a right to exist and a right to have a state, but they must realize that so do the Palestinians. And, I believe the entrenched Israeli position over the decades has made really the creation of a viable Palestinian state impossible.
Now, Martin, many people say, well, why is it that we have this obsession with what's going on in the Middle East? You know, it seems that so much of our foreign news coverage is about what's going on in the Middle East. And isn't this sort of just diverting attention away from some of the problems here at home?
Well, I mean, the Middle East is a potential flashpoint for major wars. I mean, the British Army is still deployed in Afghanistan, was deployed in Iraq. The implications of what happens in Israel clearly, and Israel-Palestine clearly has implications for these big international conflicts. And, of course, there's plenty of other things going on. BP have been in the news recently because of the oil spill in the Gulf, but they were also involved in attacks on their workers in their oil fields in Colombia. There's plenty of places which we don't hear about. But the Middle East, the Palestine-Israeli conflict, is in everybody's. Everybody has got that in the purview, and it's because it's become a symbolic test of strength, if you like. And as Simon pointed out, the Israelis are backed up in much of what they do by the Americans. I'm glad to see that William Hague has distanced himself somewhat from the American position. So we've got a. You mentioned earlier that the Jewish vote in the US is strong. Actually, most Jewish voters tend to vote for liberal candidates and have quite liberal views and not necessarily very hardline views about Israel. It's the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee is very influential, and what we're talking about here is not Jewish voters, it's Jewish money. The wealthy people behind all of this push it. Many Jewish voters in the US are quite open-minded, but they are badly represented by the organizations which claim to speak for them, but which have a great deal of power.
Well, it's just gone 5:30 now, and it's time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Simon Cook's choice of music. Now, Simon, what is this song, and why did you choose it?
I'm a great fan of Elton John, and it's from his latest album. It was produced a couple of years ago. And it's just about a song about how things happen to people and how desperately unfair life can be.
He wasn't famous, but I sure did love him. I got his picture in a little frame. He lost his life to a big disease before it even had a name. But there's so many more, and I've lost count. The hows and whys aren't important now. All that matters is they came around and brightened up our lives. She was 21 with her life ahead. You don't need to know her name. She breathed her last on the cold stone floor of a Hollywood arcade. But fate's right hand isn't always just. Puts a lot of pressure on your faith and trust. She was just a little girl and had enough to rage against the day. On the rifle range, who makes the call and who gets to choose, who gets to win and who gets to lose? It's like we're rolling dice in the belly of the blues, and blues never fade. Sun King that he was, dispatching upon his walls, and were printed onto cloth. And for reasons I never understood about the choices made between the bad and good, I've tried to figure out why the pain never goes away. Targets on the rifle range. Who makes the call and who gets to choose? Who gets to win?
And John there with the choice of our guest, Simon Cook. And now we have a report from Marina Morris on healthy lifestyle.
Hello. Hello. According to a study published in Health Statistic Quarterly, summer 2010, published by Office of National Statistic, the average life expectancy of a man in Britain is around 77 years, and a woman, 81 years. These figures, however, are subanalyzed by where people live. The results are particularly remarkable. The fifth of the people living in the most deprived areas, compared to the fifth living in the least disadvantaged areas, experience life expectancy shorter by nearly 8 years for men and 5 years for women. Quite a big difference. A male in a heavily populated, most advantageous urban areas has a life expectancy of 80.3 years, and in most deprived, 72.3 years. A female in the same most advantageous advantageous areas, 83.6 years, and most disadvantageous, 76.1 years. Life expectancy was also higher in rural areas compared to urban areas. And within rural areas, life expectancy was higher in smaller communities, such as villages rather than in the towns. These results are broadly consistent with other similar studies. However, comparison through time with earlier studies show these health inequality gaps are growing wider. Other studies have shown that life expectancies are lowest in urban areas with a history of unemployment in heavy manufacturing and mining. The study is intended to direct health policy to address these health inequalities. But why do they exist in the first place? We can speculate. The last Labour government would tell us of the vast increase in funding directed towards health care during its year. But if private health care is not in some ways better than public, why would anyone pay? And who is most likely to be able afford to pay? When in our own areas we see relatively affluent areas bordering on the much less affluent areas, can it be simple geography or it's much more likely to involve lifestyle in some ways? What is the incidence of drug addiction, alcoholism or heavy drinking, smoking, violent crime, poor diet, education, exercise or numerous other factors within these communities? Is it one factor or a combination of many? The data does not tell us. The question is, what can we do about things to improve our prospects if we live in one of these communities without all moving to Clifton? We can consciously take care of ourselves. We can value our health. Don't forget, every day of life is special.
Thanks, Marina. Now, I'll start with you, Simon. Are you someone that consciously has a healthy lifestyle? Are you cycling? Are you down the gym all the time?
I'm not down the gym all the time. I, for a long time, had a regime of running very regularly, pounding my way around the Downs in Bristol. But my knees have begun to complain a bit about that. So and now I cycle a lot, and I puff up Park Street. I can be seen doing that most days.
Okay, Martin, what about you?
Well, I wouldn't say I had a massively healthy lifestyle. I do a lot of walking in the country. That's probably the healthiest thing that I do. I go for long walks.
If you're going to stay healthy, you've got to get out of breath. You've got to do what Simon does and actually
well,
get up Park Street.
If you're going uphill up a mountain, you're out of breath, even if you're not going very fast.
Absolutely.
Now, what about this more serious point, though, about the split which has happened under the Labour administration over the last 10 years or so, of actually a bigger difference between the affluent areas like Clifton and not-so-affluent areas?
Well, it's very hard to just. I mean, obviously, there's a number of factors involved here, and you could you know
Income inequality. Yeah, and it's getting bigger.
Health inequality has been a fact of life for a very long time. We all know about that. The fact that it's got worse under a Labour government, I think, is probably indicative of the fact that the Labour government didn't, in fact, do much to reduce inequality. And I think Simon will probably recognise this. I recognise it. They basically inherited a certain kind of political economy from the previous Conservative regime, and they basically carried on with that. And despite all the huffing and puffing, inequality carried on rising. And I'm afraid it will carry on rising unless steps are taken, as they were taken in the past, to reduce those inequalities. I mean, the biggest changes in people's health were after the war in Britain, when a National Health Service was put in place by a Labour government, and that massively reduced health inequality. What we've seen in the last period of Labour government is that those inequalities of health, as many other inequalities, were not tackled, and that's a great shame and a missed opportunity.
Simon, do you think this is something that your group at the council feels that they have to tackle, or is it something you just have to leave to the doctors and to people's own individual preferences?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, the council can play its part in all sorts of ways, and you know, we have things like healthy eating initiatives, and through our leisure centres, trying to get people to take more exercise. And you know, what Martin says is right. If you just walking is actually good for you, instead of going everywhere by car or everywhere by bus, you know, if you get into the centre of the city, have a walk round the centre of the city with your shopping, and there's simple things you can do, because actually taking exercise is one of the most potent things you can do in terms of promoting your health. And it's walking, have a little run, get yourself a little bit out of breath, and you can do that anywhere, and it's free. you know, you don't have to pay to go to a gym to do these things. There's a lot that we can encourage people to do. Like, for instance, the NHS are sponsoring us in the Harbour Festival. They're sponsoring the dance stage again. Dance is a fantastic way to take aerobic exercise.
I do a lot of dancing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's brilliant for you. Gets you out of breath, really gets you moving, gets you excited, gets all your endorphins going. Fantastic.
Okay, on to a slightly more serious story now, and this is the showing of the football in Queen's Square, which I know you've been involved in, Simon. Now, there was a rather disturbing letter in the Evening Post this week from someone who says her family day out to see the football was ruined as she was enjoying herself within the atmosphere when her brother phoned to say that he was outside and couldn't get in because of overcrowding and the security staff were preventing further people entering. But then to make matters worse, she goes on to say how she was then with her elderly mother, I believe, was not actually allowed out. That's Tina Chenoweth from Knowle. So can you tell us why we had the problems last weekend with the game between England and the United States in Queen Square?
Yeah, I think there was a miscalculation. We had established that the square could take 11,000 people, and that was the limit we were licensed for. When we got to letting in 8,000 people, the police and the event management company felt there was a problem at the bar. There were a lot of people queuing at the bar, and they felt that that was potentially dangerous. So what they did was close the gates until that had, or to allow that situation to ease. And I think that was the mistake, because you could see outside, actually, there weren't more than 1,000, 2,000 people trying to get in. We could have let those people in and there would have been space inside. So I think there was, you know, always in these instances, you take decisions for the best possible reasons and you think you're doing the right thing. And hindsight's a very easy thing. But on reflection, I think, you know, we shouldn't have closed the gates. We should have let people in. I think then it would have been fine because the atmosphere inside, and I was inside the whole time, was really good. And of course people were boisterous, they were knocking footballs around and things like that, and yes, they were drinking, but actually it was very good humoured and there were children running around inside. I had no worries for their safety at all. It was the frustration outside that people got, were obviously very disappointed and got worked up about. That that was the mistake on reflection. Now we are ticketing it. We're making it a dry event for the games, and I don't think we'll have those problems again. But you know, it's these things. Look, we've learnt a lot, and we'll make sure we get it right.
Do you think it's appropriate to have a sort of outside event management company come in to do this? Can the council do this kind of thing themselves in house?
Well, we wanted to employ an event management company. The one we use, they manage Glastonbury. They're very experienced. Yes, I think it is appropriate to do that because they simply have a lot of the skills that we don't necessarily have. Our events team anyway are extremely busy preparing for the Harbour Festival, so this particular event was offered to us very late. There wasn't really time for our in-house staff to do that and everything else, so we had to bring in an events management company. I think that was the right thing to do.
So who ultimately pays for this? Is it local council taxpayers for the events like this, special events?
Well, Hyundai are paying for the screen, and they've given us money as well to cover security and stewarding. We are selling concessions within, so we hope the thing will break even, but we have set aside a contingency just in case it doesn't.
And also, I'd like an explanation as to why England didn't win.
Well, I think we're going to look for that explanation tonight. And will Robert Green be in goal? I hear that he will, which actually I think he's a great goalie. And look, you can't blame person for one mistake, can you?
Martin, what about you with this with the football? Have you been following it?
To some extent, I'm more of a rugby man, but yes, I have been following it.
And we haven't made a very good start. The England team hasn't really made a great first impact. And, you know, we're really going to have to win this next game against Algeria. I think that's tonight, in order to stay in. I mean, we're already in the situation where we may be out.
Well, I think one of the problems for the England team is that they face such massive expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, the Swiss team beat, I can't remember who they beat, Spain this week. And, of course, they weren't expecting to win. So it was a great big boost for the Switzerland, and everybody was really pleased about it. Actually, Swiss have got similar problems to us. Their economy's in a bit of a mess, and there's all sorts of things that people are upset about. And they got a national boost from winning over Spain. But the England team always go in with 1966 as their benchmark. You know, why haven't we won it completely? And that puts them under an awful lot of pressure. And that's always been the way, sadly.
It's funny as well, these world competitions, they're held at, you know, the end, I suppose they have to be held at the end of the season, when all the footballers are knackered, aren't they? Have been playing, you know, game after game after game for week on end.
Well, I mean, the British Football Federation, whatever it is, I can't remember the name of who runs our football, but I mean, in the past, the FA, they were never happy about these international competitions at one stage, because it's taking people away from the national game, you know, the actual, you know, what they're actually paid to do, playing for their local teams.
Okay, on to a slightly more serious story, and this is Iceland, who is rewriting the law to create a haven for investigative reporting. We're hearing that Iceland has passed a sweeping reform of its media laws that supporters say will make the country an international haven for investigative journalism. And I suppose this means, really, essentially what they're doing there is they're saying you can print stuff and you're not going to be told that there's an injunction saying you can't put it in the newspaper the next day. Is this something you're pleased to see, Simon?
Well, no, I love journalists, Tony. And have you packed your bags yet to go off to Iceland?
I've got my virtual server over there, yes.
I was pleased to see this was passed in the Parliament, which has the splendid name of the All Thingy, as opposed to the Other Thingy. I don't know. I've only just heard this when I walked in here today. I'm all for the freedom of the press. And, you know, as long as we can preserve the freedom of journalists to be able to dig around and hassle us politicians, that's a good thing.
Yeah, but what when they're printing stuff which isn't accurate? Because that's, I suppose, the main thing which dissuades big newspapers from publishing controversial stories, is because they're nervous if they get something wrong, then they're going to be sued for hundreds of thousands of pounds.
I haven't noticed them being that nervous, actually.
Well, I know the Daily Mail, for example, quite notorious, and Private Eye as well, for attracting these kind of, you know, a large claim against a newspaper or a publisher can actually close down a magazine.
This, like everything else, is always a matter of balance, isn't it? And, I don't know much about what's happened in Iceland, but, you know, generally, journalists have to be responsible, just as politicians and everybody else has to be responsible, reasonable. But, you know, what we have to do is preserve the freedom of the press to be able to, in some ways, challenge us politicians, challenge those who are in the establishment in any country, and preserve the freedom of the individual. That is the most paramount thing.
Martin, this is largely to do with, I think, a company called, on a website called WikiLeaks, isn't it? And the Pentagon are chasing them right now.
Yes. Well, the WikiLeaks leaks this footage of the helicopter attack in Iraq, which killed two journalists and a number of bystanders.
This is actually filmed from the helicopter itself, and it was the
official who leaked it is now under arrest in the United States. I've forgotten his name. I think it's Bradley. You know, so he's a whistleblower, in fact, and he's now going to be punished for leaking this footage.
But if he's working for the military, surely he's under something like the American equivalent of the Official Secrets Act. He can't just go getting any little bit of film he likes and giving it to WikiLeaks, can he?
Well, I think that sometimes what you need is a whistleblower's law. Or so that if something is really out of order, then you have a defence in law that this is something that should be shown. They've also got footage of a massive attack in Afghanistan, which they're trying to bring out at the moment, in which, you know, scores of people were killed at a wedding. I think we do need to see what happens in war. What's happened with this war on terror is, unlike Vietnam, we've not seen all the blood and gore, and that's been a very, very careful media strategy by those behind it all. Because if people really had to watch what was going on, they might question it more profoundly. And in the Icelandic case, the reason why they've been so keen to have this new law is because it was investigative journalists who exposed most of what was going on in their own private banks, which they didn't have private banks in Iceland until 2003, and then they decided to drink the Kool-Aid and got private banks, and now they've ended up with this massive debt which they don't want to pay. And there's a very good case for them to say that they don't want to pay it. But I mean, if what will happen, of course, if Iceland does become a haven for this kind of journalism, is that with the internet, things will leak from Iceland into other domains, and it will be impossible for the establishment to stop those things being said. And that's probably a good thing, because there's an awful lot of things that need exposing, whether it's oil leaks, killing of civilians, financial skullduggery. I mean, we need a really robust press at the moment.
But what a lot of the finance people in the European Union are saying is, if the Icelandic government decide they're not going to pay the debt, then they're not going to join the European Union.
Many people in Iceland are saying, well, that's not much of a threat. We're not that bothered to join the European Union. They've also been told they'll get no more inward investment if they don't pay what they supposedly owe. And they're also saying, well, that's not much of a threat because we're not going to get any inward investment anyway. The rules of capitalism are, if you lend money to somebody and they don't pay you back, you've lost it. What we're actually saying to Iceland is, oh no, you've got to pay this money back. Now, that isn't the rules of capitalism. That's not what it says in the textbook. What it says in the textbook, if you lend people money and you don't get it back, then you've lost it. That's why you were paid interest when you lend people money. That's why all of the people who had their money in these Icelandic banks were quite happy to have their money in there, because they paid a good rate of interest. That good rate of interest was to cover the possibility that it wouldn't be paid back. Now, that is the rules of the game. And if you've lost your money, you've lost your money. And that's one of the problems we've had with this whole financial crisis, is that we're not following the textbook. People have basically said, we want our bets to be covered because we're not allowed to lose. Well, maybe that's got to be challenged, and challenged strongly.
Okay, what looks like our final story probably this week is members of the European Parliament have rejected something called the traffic light food labelling system. Members of the European Parliament yesterday were accused of caving in to pressure from the food industry after plans for compulsory introduction of traffic light colour-coded front-of-pack food labels, which would have applied in the UK, were rejected by 400 MEPs following a multi-million pound lobbying campaign by big food manufacturers. So, Simon, what about this? It does sound like whatever is the Food Standards Agency says would be good for our food labelling, the big multinationals are able to sort of clobber it in the European Parliament.
Yeah, I think that's a bit worrying. Obviously, look, things, too much salt, too much sugar, too much fat can be bad for you. Although I have to say that, you know, as every day goes by, the kind of medical stories change, don't they? Some days alcohol is good for you, sometimes it's bad for you.
But this is really about clarity, I think. I mean, because the food labelling as it stands is actually... I mean, I don't know how, if you pick up everything you're about to buy and read through all these little sort of boxes and diagrams, and it's quite complex now. I think this is really an attempt by the FSA to clarify things.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, is it based on the very latest research? Is there going to be other research that comes out and maybe turns a red to an amber or an amber to a green? You know, I don't know. On the face of it, it sounds a good idea. And yes, it sounds worrying that, you know, multinationals have been able to put the pressure on in this way to persuade your MPs to turn it down. Again, we all have to be sensible. There are basic things we know are better for us than other things. You know, so don't eat too much crisps. You know, eat a nice amount of vegetables. We're told that five a day now isn't the base minimum, whereas the medical profession used to say it was. You know, don't drink too much alcohol, take exercise. So, you know, I still think we are able to judge for ourselves, but some kind of, yeah, very simple system would be helpful to people.
Martin, do you ever read the little labels on food when you're buying it to see what's actually in it?
Sometimes.
But what do you think about what's happened here yesterday in the European Parliament?
I think it's clearly what we've got here is industry lobbying behind the scenes to get what it wants, which is pretty much, you know, the story generally about the way the world works. There was lack of regulation in the financial markets. There was lack of regulation of BP in the Gulf of Mexico. And we've got to get away from this idea that all regulations are bad. Bonfire of the red tape, let business get on with the job and all the rest of it. Regulations are essential if you are going to have a fair level playing field, and that the bad producer doesn't drive out the good producer. And if you think about this in terms of football, the refereeing has got to be excellent. Otherwise, the game isn't a game anymore. It's becoming a gamesmanship game where you can play hard and fast with the rules. And good, solid rules that everybody understands are clearly in everybody's interest. And I'm rather worried that they've been able to overturn what was quite a sensible suggestion.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Clifton East and Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council, Simon Cook. After the news, a more detailed look at Chancellor George Osborne's Mansion House speech, which he made to the great and good of the City of London earlier this week. And our former Parachute Regiment reporter, Bryn Richard Cowley, looks at the big news of the week, that is the Savile report, which came out into the Bloody Sunday killings. Has the £191 million report thrown any light on whether soldiers, senior officers or politicians of the day were responsible? Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.